The Lohman Abner program exited the airwaves some 13 years ago, leaving behind thousands of devoted fans who, to this day, reserve a place in their memories for the long-running series. Chester, or Chet Locke, was, and to some degree still is, Lum, one of two men who created a unique sort of entertainment. Abner was played by Norris Goff. Locke has returned to Arkansas to live and is now a partner in a Hot Springs public relations agency. He's not exactly the picture of the rural gentleman he portrayed. Locke and his partner occupy a modern suite in a six-month-old office building near downtown Hot Springs. In the back lot sits a late-model Thunderbird bearing one license plate which reads simply, Lum. On one wall of Locke's office, a series of cartoons and photographs from the radio days, one of the latter showing six men, three teams, Laurel and Hardy, Amos and Andy, Lum and Abner. As we begin the interview, Locke comments that the photo was taken in Hollywood's old Brown Derby restaurant, that it was the only time the teams ever got together. The subject switches to something more current. Mr. Locke, I understand there's a chance the old programs may actually get back on the air.
There's a strong possibility. Yeah, we closed the old John Down store back in 1954, and it has recently been revived in Hot Springs, Arkansas.
What brought about this revival?
Well, the manager of the local station here, now carrying the program, asked me about it some time ago and said if they ever became available to please give them first refusal. Well, I finally decided if it's ever going to get the program reestablished, it might be well to put it on one station and see what the reaction would be. So far, we're delighted with the reaction. The number of letters and phone calls and the comments made about town. And consequently, we've had, because of the newspaper publicity and radio publicity concerning its revival, we've had many, many phone calls from all over the country, especially in Arkansas.
How did the entire idea for a program such as yours originate?
Well, we both lived over in Mena, Arkansas. And we had been doing some amateur theatricals around Mena and established sort of a local reputation. And for the name of Campbell Arno, who was the then manager of KTHS here in Hot Springs, heard about us and invited us over to broadcast. And we had been doing blackface. And on our way over, we decided we better do something different because Amos and Andy had started by this time. And the two black crows were very popular. There must have been four or five blackface teams. Quite a fad at that particular time. So in order to keep a separate identity, we decided on a couple of rural characters. And on the spur of the moment, we named them Lum Edwards and Abner Peabody. Later, it became Lum and Abner, of course. And then he invited us back, I believe, five consecutive weeks. And by this time, we'd had enough fan mail and enough encouragement that we decided to go to Chicago, had a letter of introduction to the program manager of NBC, and they offered us a job on sustaining, which we declined. But while we were still in Chicago, he called us and asked us to come down for an audition with Quaker Oats Company, and they bought the act. So suddenly, we found ourselves engaged for a network show, and we had to come back to Arkansas to take a leave of absence from our respective jobs. I don't know if that job's still open or not.
Were there any pitfalls in actually first getting the program on the air?
No, not really. We were inexperienced in writing script. And naturally, the network insisted on a copy of the script. But we soon learned how to write the script. Up until that point, we'd just been ad-libbing the show.
Was this typical of many of the big-name stars, starting out on a small local station, then merely making a trip to the networks and announcing that I'm here?
Well, I think there's a different story connected with each show that I'm familiar with. I know how the Fibber McGee and Molly show got its start. I know how Amos and Andy was a vaudeville team. And the Chicago Tribune conceived the idea of, they owned WGN in Chicago, They conceived the idea of running a radio station just as you would a newspaper, with its editorial department, its women's department, its financial pages, and even the comic strip. And at that time, they had a cartoon strip running in the Tribune called Sam and Henry. So they decided to dramatize that cartoon series. And a fellow by the name of Henry Sullinger was assigned the job of finding somebody to do the parts. So happened that Correll and Garson were playing a local theater, so they were invited out to audition for the parts along with some others. And Correll and Garson got the job. Well, they caught on immediately, and soon they withdrew from WGN and put it on a network under their own show. They did not own the name of Sam and Henry. Mm-hmm. So they started calling the characters Amos and Andy. They didn't change the format at all, just the names of the characters. That's how they got started. Well, there's an interesting story behind every show that I'm familiar with.
How many years did it take for your program to really catch on?
Well, we were put on both the Red and the Blue Network at that particular time, and that gave us tremendous exposure. Later, that became ABC and NBC, of course. Then I believe the thing that gave us more prestige than anything up to that time, we were signed by Ford Motor Company. They had never had a radio show prior to that time. That was back in 1932. And we were on for Ford for 2 or 3 years. When our contract terminated, we went immediately with Horlicks Malted Milk. And from there to General Foods, and from General Foods to Alka-Seltzer, and then to General Motors was one of our last sponsors.
Did the fact that you did your programs live give you any great difficulty?
Well, I didn't mind the actual broadcast of it. You were almost a prisoner to the show because we couldn't tape in advance. We never could find a sponsor that would allow us to tape it or record it prior to the program, and we had to do a live show. And we used to argue with them that we could do a much better job if we could put it on tape and hear it back and know how we could improve it and correct any mistakes. But they insisted on a live show. That's what they got. We did one that went back east after we got to Hollywood, where we spent most of our time. We did a show, I believe, about 3:30 in the afternoon or 3:15, and another one at 6:15.
How long has it been since you've seen Norris Goff?
Oh, he was here last summer for about a week visiting. So I've been living in Houston for the past 12 years, since 1955. That was soon after it went off the air. And he remained in California. He lives in Palm Desert.
Mr. Long, do you think there's any great chance the old type of radio might come back with its dramas and comedies?
Well, I still contend that radio offers more of an opportunity for dramatized programs than television, because with radio, you get a more vivid picture because you're exercising your own imagination. I think the image that the viewer or listener gets from radio is much stronger than that of television, where it's all spelled out for you.
I think
there's a strong possibility, and I base that on the reaction since our program has been revived here in Hot Springs. I've had at least 25 phone calls from stations throughout the country interested in putting it on their station. Some of them don't even ask the price, but I'll take it at any price.
What about financing for such programs? Do you think the money is actually available?
Oh, no question about it. It'd be a simple matter. They could offer the show, and the stations that were interested could take the show or reject it as they saw fit. I think if you could come on with a national sponsor, it'd be a simple matter to syndicate it or put it on the entire network.
What single event do you remember most about your entire broadcast career?
Well, of course, now it's old hat, but at the time we did it, it was quite a thrill. I remember back in 1938, I believe it was, We were the first team to broadcast a program simultaneously from London and Chicago. I was in London and Abner was in Chicago. We had the same script, and with headphones, we did the show just as though we were in the same studio together. And it was broadcast over the NBC network and the British Broadcasting System.
Were there any unique technical problems in getting a program such as yours on the air in the early days?
No, of course, the microphones were not nearly as sensitive as today's microphones. We used the old carbon mics, and I imagine a great many in our audience were using the old crystal sets in the beginning, especially. I do recall one thing, the question of sound equipment, sound effects. We used to have to concoct our own sound effects. Now they have an elaborate sound effects department in most, especially networks and some individual stations. But at that time, we had to create our own sound effects. We spent more time improvising different methods of creating a certain sound effect than we did working on our program, actually.
When you first went on the air, were you surprised at the amount of hero worship that radio stars were given?
I really was, and I never ceased to be. I remember back in 1933, we started making some personal appearances. And we broadcast five nights a week, and then we'd go out on Saturdays and Sundays and play a theater all through Ohio and Kentucky and Indiana and Illinois, that area. And I never ceased to be amazed at the number of people who came out just to see what we looked like. We had never released any publicity or released any pictures showing that we were young fellows. And when we did a skit in character, in costume, makeup, and then stripped it off and came back out straight, there was an amazed audience. They just couldn't believe that we were really young fellows. When we started making pictures, it just used to take about 2.5 hours to make me up to look the age of the part of Lum. My hairline was too youthful, and of course my hair was perfectly black, no wrinkles. They used to spend a lot of time putting wrinkles in my face and putting on a gray wig with more elderly hairline. And now I'm pretty sure I could just walk through the makeup room right onto the set without any problem.
Where did you get the many ideas for your episodes?
It was strictly off the top of our head, using an acute imagination, which I think we both had and must have had to keep it going for 24 years. But I'll tell you, we reached some impasses on occasion where we just didn't know where to go. So we developed a method when we hit a high center like that, just sit down and start writing something, and pretty soon something would evolve out of it.
Were the programs always 15 minutes in length?
Yes, we did a series with General Motors for Frigidaire, a 30-minute show once a week where we had a full cast. We had Zazu Pitts and Andy Devine and Charlie Weaver, Cliff Arquette. He later started using the name Charlie Weaver, but he was practically the same character on our show. And we had a fellow named Opie Cates who happened to be from Arkansas. And that was our regular cast. And occasionally we'd have a guest star on the show.
Do people still primarily associate you with the role you once played?
Yes, they do. And so often people will subconsciously call me Lum and apologize for it. I said, don't apologize. That old fellow's pretty good to me. Yeah, you can call me Lum anytime you want to.
Have any of your 10 movies ever been released to television?
Yes, they were once, about 10 years ago. And I own six of those pictures myself, and I expect to release those again soon.
Did you ever make a try at a television series?
No. The reason being, just shortly before television reared its ugly head, my partner, Norris Goff, Tuffy Goff, we call him, had an operation for cancer. And he had a couple of heart attacks, and we knew that he couldn't stand the grind of television because the last picture we made, he was ill
Drummond Abner television series done with other actors.
Oh, yes. That they made a pilot film on one occasion just a few years ago, but it wasn't a good pilot. They had Edgar Buchanan doing the part of Abner and, I can't think of the fellow's name from, he's really from Arkansas, who did the part of Lum, Arthur Honeycutt. And I think he was from that area around Pine Ridge. It wasn't well directed, wasn't a good script, and although they're both great performers, the pilot film didn't come off.
Is there anything you regret about your years as Lum?
Well, I think we took it maybe too much for granted. We walked on for so long. Maybe we weren't giving it as much effort as we should have. We had the advantage of being already established when competition came along. We had that advantage. Maybe we didn't work as hard at it as we should have, but maybe that was good. I don't know. Sometimes when you try too hard on a radio program or pictures or television, it reflects it in the production.
Were the majority of your programs from Hollywood?
We went to Hollywood in 1937 and remained there for the balance of the time. Now, during that period of time, occasionally we had to go to Chicago or New York or Washington, and on such occasions we'd have to emanate our show from that particular spot.
How was it that the recordings you do have of the programs were kept?
Well, they were stored. I guess our secretary must have handled it, but they were stored at one of the Deacon's storage place in Hollywood.
Mm-hmm.
And dug them out. We kept them in the office for many years, and when we closed our office in Hollywood, I guess somebody must have taken them to Deacon's.
Do you know if any of the other big-time radio stars saved their own programs?
Well, now, I talked to George Burns about a year ago and asked him if he had any of his old programs. He said, yes, he had them all. So maybe a lot of those people, maybe Jack Benny's kept all of his old shows. I'm pretty sure he must have.
Mr. Locke, would you have any parting words for the audience?
No, I'd like to see radio come back as it once was. And I don't. George, I never have understood why management in radio turned tail and ran when television came along.
Mm-hmm.
I still think they had the greatest media. And greatest of all the media. As I said a while ago, because the listener is permitted to exercise his own imagination and get a more vivid picture. I think we had more loyal fans in radio than we have in television. Very few television shows you feel is a must. But there were certain shows on radio where your fans wouldn't have missed it under any circumstances.
Thank you very much, sir.
A conversation with Chet Luck of the Lum and Abner programs.